This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Stuart Peckham,
Jane Bolton,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now last week we were talking about your time in farming, but you also said that you were involved in various organisations, including some political ones.
Yes, originally my father was very involved in the National Party up around Gisborne where we lived, and later on I became interested too. I always like to know what's going on in New Zealand and the world, and how decisions are made, and the background to these decision making. And so we lived at the time in the Pāhiatū electorate, where Sir Keith Holyoake was our Member of Parliament, and he was a good entertainer. He always could speak well and always keep an audience well informed. So I used to go along to the meetings when he used to come to Pongaroa, as it was at the time, and I got involved in being the local branch chairman, which wasn't a really a big thing, and then I became the electorate chairman of the Pāhiatū electorate for 5 years. And after Sir Keith Holyoake, John Falloon was our Member of Parliament, and so I got to know his activities, and it was interesting to go to the meetings and find out how the electorate ran. And we used to have a lot of branches around the electorate, and to see who was involved, and particularly when we had Sir Keith Holyoake and then John Falloon as our MPs. And I used to go to meetings in various parts of New Zealand to hear what was going on. And then we came to the Manawatu, and I joined up with the Halcombe Waituna West branch and came into electorate meetings. And our Member of Parliament at the time was Simon Power, and then Ian McKelvey, and now we've got Suze Redmayne. And find out what goes on and what a huge job they've got trying to keep in touch with people and know what's going on, and also make representations down in Parliament. And what's sort of interesting.
Your involvement was the National Party. Was that an automatic choice?
Yes, I suppose it was, actually. I've always had a sort of a centre-right viewpoint on activities, and the farmers in the earlier days used to get knocked around by the freezing work strikes and transport strikes, so that didn't endear us to left-hand viewpoints of how hard everybody was.
But also, you were farming right through all the SMP, supplementary minimum prices, and then the reforms when Labour came in 84 and so on. Was that a traumatic time?
You just had to sort of get on with it.
Was it a shock seeing Labour moving so far to the right, essentially?
I can't remember.
No. Okay, it was just a shock. Suddenly finding it happened. So did it affect you very much?
Our bank balance mainly had to sort of keep going. And there were some pretty difficult times when you knew that you'd send sheep to the works, and then a day later or the same day you'd get a phone call from your carrier saying that the freezing workers were on strike.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So all the sheep had to be returned and they'd lost a bit of condition. And
it and also the cost of the
transport.
Yeah. You have to wear that as
That's
well.
Right, yeah. Mm.
Didn't endear you to the unions.
No, not at all. No.
Yeah. So you would have seen this in a way from the inside in the National Party, how they viewed it. And so what were the, did they think, what can we do about this? Or did they have a strategy?
Not that I can quickly remember, except to try and get back to a satisfactory way of farming and living. And,
Okay.
So, the Longburn freezing works just south of Palmerston North, that used to go on strike regularly, and that didn't help anybody.
And they probably did more harm for themselves than anything,
And the Partia freezing works, which in South Taranaki, that used to regularly go on strike, and then eventually the owners had had enough of it and they shut it up.
Yeah. Which was a loss of jobs for all those working.
Yeah.
They all lost their jobs.
Yeah.
Longburn as well.
Yeah.
Huge loss.
Yeah, it's a, and a lot of that, I suppose, was due, the perception at that stage was, I mean, now when, in fact, I was studying sociology at university as a cool paper back in the late 1960s, and then it was all a matter of class and elites and hierarchies. Yeah. Now it's gender and ethnicity, but at that time there was the idea of you've got the capitalist bosses and you've got the unions representing the workers, and the bosses oppress the workers and the workers that fight. So it was just a worldview then that has totally changed now.
I think we all realise that we all are part of the overall picture of prosperity in New Zealand, and if anybody sort of or group upsets it, well, there's so many people are affected.
So you were observing the political side. Did you actually get involved in it? Were there any issues that you took up yourself?
No, I don't think so. We could sort of go to meetings, say this and that should happen, but I wasn't far enough up the chain of influence to be able to do anything.
So did he get a sense of where the policy ideas were coming from? Was it by politician or was it by policy analysts? Because you've got children working working in this area.
A lot of the policy came from, you might say, the grassroots farmers who were initially intimately affected by all these strikes, and they could see how harmful it was to so many people. Brighter farmers could sort of suggest that New Zealand should develop along a better line in the future.
So that they could see an issue, that you thought they could actually see a solution as well, rather than just say this is the problem? So, and what were they advocating? Somehow undermine the strength of the unions?
Well, we knew that the unions were very, very strong, and they had leaders who could influence what the members did, like go on strike, this sort of thing. And we knew that the unionists and their families were also affected by not having income and years. But you get along with these things and you try and advocate for a better way.
Did you see a town-country divide as well?
We thought there was quite a significant one. But, these things pass. I don't think there's anything like that nowadays.
Sometimes it's lack of communication.
Oh, yes.
I always say communicate with everybody.
I suppose but farming as well has changed now from being the sort of family business with a lot of farmers involved. Now it's gone. Has it gone more corporate?
Yes.
How has that affected? Does it affect the politics as well as the community.
Yes, right? These things evolve or take a place. Fielding is full of businesses which are owned by corporates or New Zealand-wide groups. Yes, and we just accept them. That's the way it happens. And it's very, very tough for a small trader to try and remain profitable.
Yeah, we saw that. Yeah, in fact, I think, you know, builders' supplies and so on, there used to be several independent ones in just in Fielding, never mind Palmerston North. And those are all sort of national or international chains now. But for farmers as well, you've got more and more agglomeration of farms. Yeah. And is there more corporatisation of farming as well, with managers?
There is. And I belong... We've got shares in a group in Fielding which has kiwi fruit and dairy farms and lots of other farming activities. And they're sort of run by people sitting in chairs and offices, and they hopefully make good decisions. And
so how was that set up?
By some Massey graduates.
Okay.
They just... his father was a academic in Wellington, and this young fellow went to Massey, did a degree, and headed off, became a shear milker.
Yeah.
And then with another fellow, they set up this corporate style of farming, initially dairy farming. Mm-hmm. And we're involved within that group of, we've got vineyards and kiwi fruit. And we've had one or two crashes. Things happen.
But because you're diversified, you can actually weather that, and you can spend some time developing new areas. And
the corporates can get in huge amounts of money very quickly. Yes. Because it seems that some people have got heaps of money to invest.
Yeah. So are they listed on the stock market?
Or? No.
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 So you've got to know the people to...
Pretty well, yes. Yep. And looking at the names of the shareholders, a lot of them have Asian or what we'll call overseas names.
Now this is in, because there's the question, should New Zealand land be sold to overseas interests and things, but they're actually buying into New Zealand land-owning businesses, essentially. So it's indirectly buying land.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, a lot of overseas people or groups, so I believe, have bought our hill country, planted pine trees, and they get paid a carbon reward.
They get the karma credits and things. Yeah. I suppose the question, are they buying the land or the planting rights for the
they've got the money, the corporate
they've got
money.
Lots of money.
Yes.
Do those carbon credits stay in New Zealand or do they go overseas?
The people who get them.
The people who get, they get the checks overseas.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can't stop progress, and but it hurts me and a lot of other farmers to see this hill country going into pine trees.
Yeah. Well, these are things that are happening perhaps now. We've got Kiwi Saver and Tom Australia, massive pension funds. And we saw even earlier with Japanese pension funds, and they had lots of money to pour in, so they'd just be buying New Zealand government stock. So a lot of things are being driven, not necessarily by the economics of the use of the money itself, but the purpose for the investment.
Yes, it's things change.
So it's all changing. So on the politics then. So you see a lot of the politicians. You have a lot of close contact with politicians.
Not a lot, but we have meetings in Fielding frequently, and our member of parliament will talk to us, and other people will members will come and might have a luncheon or dinner. Yeah. And politics is a pretty expensive sort of operation. We have obligations, or each electorate has obligations to a head office to fund the business side down there. And
So you're doing loads of fundraising.
Yeah.
And that was for the Victory Fund?
Yes. There's
the Victory Fund? What's that?
Every 3 years we have our elections, as we know, and... each electorate is required to pay a certain amount of money each year to head office, and this is called the Victory Fund.
And that's National Party.
Head of population, is it? Depending how much you have to say.
Yes, something probably. There's.
Well, it's like having Jews.
So this Victory Fund, which is for spending in election year, is divided by three, and each electorate is required to find that one third every year.
Okay.
It's always a target which we have to meet.
Mm. Yeah. Okay.
So this is why I say it's an expensive business.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that there's talk now about we're moving more towards career politicians.
Yes.
You've noticed that?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of them, I think of some of the current career politicians, they're quite good. Mm. They haven't probably ever dirtied their hands with honest work after leaving university. But that's the way it seems to be.
You're right, that they'd all be university graduates now, and
mostly.
And that would be a big change as well, would it?
Mostly, yeah.
So the idea of people being representative of the population
that's the way it is.
Yeah. So what, do you have a view on the future of farming in New Zealand, as it's getting sort of maybe somewhat less significant overall, or you don't see it that way?
No, I think it's got a good future. People have got to eat, and the wool industry is pretty tired at the moment. I can recall when wool was total about half our farm income, and those are the days when most of our coarse wool was sold to Russia for making into heavy greatcoats for the troops.
Okay.
But nowadays wool isn't quite so much in demand. But food, yes, we still have good requirements to sell our meat overseas, and our fruit also goes.
Is there a strong push for value added? It's a term people throw around, but it's not necessary. Maybe we're good at grain, but not so good at the specific targeting markets. But
not too sure. I don't know too much about that.
Okay.
But you can only, I guess, sell it to somebody who's willing to buy it.
Yeah.
So there's always that sort of.
Do you see a big distance between the farmers you're selling at the farm gate, and there's all the other stuff that, is there much communication back and forth about?
Pretty good, yes. Yeah? Yes, okay. There's agents who, and Federated Farmers representatives who know what's going on.
Okay. So you can adapt to the changes that
if your land allows it to, like on hill country, there's no great ability to change, but on this sort of country here, yes, you can maybe plant different crops.
Did you ever think of diversifying at all, or that didn't fit the sort of farm?
When we're out of Manor 2, we used to grow grain and other crops.
Yeah.
But when we were initially farming out of Dannevirke, we used to grow the occasional fodder crop, but we never had any grain crop.
Okay, yeah.
And that fodder was just for winter feed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's for your own.
So were there new skills you needed for that, or different equipment that you had to get?
Yes, if you wanted to become involved, you had to gain the knowledge.
Yeah.
And also had the necessary machinery to do the cropping.
Yeah. That was difficult, expensive, or
yes,
big risk for you? You run losses for a few years as you're developing something new? Or?
Well, the bank manager always told you if your overdraft was getting too high.
Yeah.
And so that was a limitation on what you could buy or do.
Yeah.
But the weather also came into it, a huge factor.
Yeah.
The weather was kind of ruined a crop that's ready to be harvested.
Oh, yes.
The weather was against you, you've had it. Mm. The same as if you're growing cherries or strawberries, raspberries, anything, apples.
Yeah.
Oh. It's the same. Weather plays a huge part in farming.
There's another dimension I'd heard as well, where at one time you farming communities, everyone would get together for the different tasks, and that's moved over far more to contractors being used for
things. contractors, they need bigger and more expensive machinery to do, say, turning grass into baleage.
Yeah.
The machines are far more expensive than an individual farmer could justify.
Yeah.
They've got the machinery, they're very efficient, they're very quick, and very quick.
Oh, yes. Amazing.
I mean, if the farmers can get together, they start to do their own farming, plus helping their fellow farmer.
Yeah.
But with the contractors that come
they
in...
They just get in and...
So
the plus is it's more efficient, and the minus is that it weakens the communities, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right. I suppose so, yes.
Mm. Yeah.
A lot of the... rural population is shrinking now because there's more mechanisation and getting agriculture contractors to do work which might have previously been carried out by farm staff.
Yeah, which was sometimes quite unpleasant work or enjoyable work.
Yes.
I know children like being on top of the
big tractor.
I don't think some organisations would approve of that.
No, not that.
They would be...
yeah, because safety's become a far bigger thing. Yes.
And justifiably so, too.
So there were a lot of injuries and things you remember in your...
Think so. No. But, you know, nowadays you read about injuries to
people
on stuff.
On
farms.
Yeah.
Four-wheel drive the motorbikes.
Yeah.
Quads.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Not good. I'm not happy with them.
Yeah.
No, I think it's pretty well justified to make sure that safety is paramount
for
people on farms.
Yeah, and they've found the right balance, Okay, so you've had a lifetime of involved in or associated with farming and you're now retired, but if you were 20 now, or 15, 20 now, would you, you enjoyed your life obviously doing that, would you see it in the same way now? You think, you'd follow the same path again?
Probably.
Yeah.
Yes. There's so many other opportunities for people with graduates to get involved in, so many things in the community now. When you live on a farm and you work on a farm, your whole life is sort of involved with
work on
a day-to-day basis.
Because if you're a farmer, it's like if you've got your own business, basically it never ends. It's always you can't just say work. It's 5 o'clock now. I'll go home and switch off.
Christmas Day spent.
Yes.
Still have to do the same job.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose out of all those, dairy farming would be the real problem because you've got the milking that to be done, so even summer holidays. But you were able to have summer holidays?
Yes.
How does that work? Someone just keeps an eye on the stock while you're away?
We didn't get away, no.
Okay.
You usually be shearing about that time.
There's
always, you had to watch your sheep to make sure they didn't have fly strike or something like that. But the winter time was when farmers used to be able to get away.
Okay. So, and they could get away for a long time and they'd go to the Northern Hemisphere for a summer?
No.
If they had farms, if they had staff, they were more likely to be able to get away.
Yeah.
If you didn't have staff, you had to make other arrangements to get somebody to look after your dogs and
feed the chooks and exercise the horse and move the stock.
So farming's less of a career and more of a lifestyle. Yeah.
Would you say? Well, some people who like working on farms will always be working on farms, except for some people they were unable to. Send their children to a local school, so they had to board them at school, and that was a limitation for some people in the community.
In what sense a limitation?
It
wasn't the family life they wanted, involved?
Couldn't pay.
Yes,
there's the cost. Yeah. Like we had four children boarding at a high school one particular year.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
You'd go down to the bank manager and you wear your old boots that have gone to pieces and say, he's going to have some more.
But the banks are pretty understanding with the sort of needs,
yeah, the ups
financial
and downs,
needs.
Yes.
Because
I heard that, was it early on in the mid-80s with all the reforms and banks were sometimes just applying the standard formula, and then they realised, no, we can't do that. No. It's a different situation. They've learned a lot since then, do you think? They've adapted a lot.
The banks, that's where they make their money, by lending money.
If they can't lend it, then they're not getting interest.
But the idea, of course, is to keep in touch with your bank manager and tell him how you're going and why your overdraft might be a bit higher because you haven't sold sheep or cattle or something like that.
So would it be, I think some people think maybe you've got, farming, you might not have the high income, but you've got the big assets there. Yes. And that's the general, so you can be quite wealthy but not have much cash.
But they say asset rich and penny poor.
Yes,
I think everybody understood that.
Yeah. Mm. So on retirement then, suddenly you can go on a spending binge and buy all the things that you wanted to do.
When just before I retired, was the first time I came into credit during the whole time we were farming.
Yeah.
And I think that would apply to a lot of farmers, farm owners.
But that's probably, but it's a business, and you think, businesses are using capital, and if you're using capital effectively, it pays to borrow and get the return on it.
So, that was roughly it, and now here I am, retired, and can look at our other farmers and see what they're doing.
Lovely views. That's how you get on the phone and say, hey, your parents look a bit rough.
I better not do that.
No, probably not. No. I see there's lots of sort of paddocks with just one or two trees in. I remember there was a lot of talk at one time about farm forestry or trees being good for paddocks staying green in dry weather and giving shelter for the stock. Has there been much change in attitude about that?
Shelter for the stock. I think you'll find that most of the trees are in gullies.
Yes.
And that's where the land can't be cultivated, so farmers put shelter trees in the gullies.
And they fence it, or the stock can go in there for shelter themselves? Or
A bit of both. Sometimes they fence it, but otherwise it's the trees have been left over from earlier sort of land clearing.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.